You're listening to Greater LA. It's KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Today, we're off to the courtroom, where come this Monday in LA County, those will be back in session. Now, those courts have scaled back on-site business for nearly 3 months. But now, non-jury, criminal, and civil cases that have been handled remotely will be back inside the physical courtroom. Preliminary hearings will be heard, even traffic court will reopen. And I know what you're thinking. Oh yeah, the pandemic is still around. To ensure the safety of all those people inside the courtroom, LA County has adopted this initiative. It's called Here for You, Safe for You, which outlines guidelines such as the requirement of masks and social distancing in all 38 superior courthouses and courtrooms all across the county. But will it work? Well, one public defender has already died from the novel coronavirus, and there are large outbreaks at county jails. Ricardo Garcia heads up the LA County Public Defender's Office, and he's with us right now. Mr. Garcia, thanks for being here.
Hello, and thanks for having me here on your show.
You guys are obviously in the courtroom a lot. It is your workplace. I mentioned that you lost a public defender to COVID-19, and my condolences. Jails are rife with it. Do you think the courts have done enough to protect public defenders since they've been closed?
Well, you know, first of all, thank you very much for condolences on behalf of myself and my entire office. We really appreciate that.
Sure.
The loss of an attorney, for any reason, is a difficult loss for us. And in this time of crisis, any connection to the COVID infections and is even more devastating at this time. So thank you very much for that, Brian.
Of course.
You know, enough is a pretty subjective question. I think we have been through some difficult times in this process, and it's been a very steep learning curve for all of us involved. And we have been doing what we can. I think the court has been trying to listen to our concerns to get us to a point where the environment is as safe as we can hope for. Are we there yet? Not quite. Do I expect we can be? I hope so. So we have some challenges left ahead in that respect.
Well, I mean, Monday is just a few days away. Do you think you'll be there on Monday? Are you going to be as close to it as possible? Or do you have any fears for your own safety or for the safety of other public defenders in the county?
We are beginning a slow and methodical opening process with the court. We have been in limited operations, doing preliminary hearings, bail reviews and arraignments on a regular time schedule, but trials and more complex hearings have been suspended by the Judicial Council's order. That order is still in place, and so trials will not begin immediately on the 22nd, nor as we begin to slowly open. So I think with regards to the criminal arena, the presiding judge there, the supervising judge there, Judge Oda and my team have been working as well as with other justice stakeholders to try to create an environment that is safe for the community, for my lawyers, and also for my clients as they go into court and address their concerns and their matters. So we have a little bit of flexibility, a little bit more time than the 22nd.
Well, let's think about that time that you have, because obviously things will get back to full swing at some point. It's hard to imagine public defenders or prosecutors in front of jury trials giving opening arguments or closing arguments, you know, there in front of the jurors with masks on, but it's required. Do you worry that a juror who's not able to see an expression on your face, or even a suspect's face for that matter, might affect the outcome of the trial?
Absolutely. I'm today, as you and I are talking, I'm not comfortable with the idea of jury trials and masked individuals. So this is an issue we're going to have to work through and try to overcome. Santa Clara has developed a pretty creative way of doing it in a trial, and we're looking at those avenues. So when it comes to jury trials, absolutely, masks are an impediment, in my opinion, with regards to the jury's ability to assess the credibility of witnesses, the ability of a lawyer to effectively cross-examine a witness and confront that witness on behalf of their client, And even in the act of jury selection, the ability to engage the jury in a conversation and assess who is the right person to hear the case for our clients, masks get in the way of that. So we're looking for solutions. We're trying to be creative at the same time, keeping everyone safe. This is it's a pretty big challenge.
I mean, I get it. You're trying to jibe, you know, the right to a speedy trial with the right to a safe and fair trial, correct?
That's absolutely true.
So how is that being worked through? I mean, it sounds like if that's the requirement for being in court, you're going to have a mask on. Do you try and delay it even more? What do you do?
No, I think delaying a person's constitutional right to trial is not the answer. There are people sitting in custody that have absolute rights to have their matters heard. And they should have them. And that is, again, I think you pointed out in different words, the balance that we're trying to strike, the safety of the lawyers and the people in the courthouse and the absolute right of my clients to have their matters heard and be represented appropriately. That's the balance. Today, the order is everyone wears a mask. What are the alternatives? We're not sure yet. Face shields, maybe. Like I said, Santa Clara is a process where they have placed litigants in plexiglass environments that help keep them separate from each other to prevent the potential contaminants from being shared. Is it the best thing? Maybe not. Is it the right thing in that environment? It looks like it. And is that something we can do in Los Angeles? We don't know yet. We're looking at those options. The court has erected plexiglass barriers to help us create that separation and begin to look at those different options today so that if we can't have a mask, we have a public health department approved barrier between people in court.
I have so many questions, and I know we have such a limited amount of time about juries. Number one, are you afraid that potential jurors are not going to want to come to court because they're too afraid about COVID, right?
You know, I think that's an absolute possibility. And so, yeah, I that is a very real concern that I have.
And once you do get seated, you know, you're going to be in a jury box with 11 other people. I mean, those are close quarters. Are you going to spread people out that way? You put them throughout the courtroom? How are you going to handle that?
Well, I think we're going to, you know, the idea of the court, and we would support the idea of spreading individuals out. But again, it has to be the right and safe environment so that everybody can engage the trial appropriately. You know, and it's not just getting people to court and making them feel safe. It's getting diverse juries. We know that COVID-19 is disproportionately impacted the African-American and Latino communities here in Los Angeles. And so we want to make sure that that impact does not adversely impact our ability to get fair, impartial jurors that represent all of Los Angeles, not just particular parts of Los Angeles. So diversity is also a concern we have and the impact on trials.
I know a big issue for you guys right now is the budget. The pandemic has decimated the economy. Governments are being asked to do without or do with much less. My understanding is that your office is funded completely by the county, right? And then the DA gets a lot of extra funding to sort of supplement the budget from things like government grants. So what's the difference in funding between your office and the DA's office? And how are you guys affected by all these budgetary concerns?
Well, the DA's budget is larger than ours, and that clearly impacts the day-to-day operations on both sides. But as far as the current impact, we're still trying to assess that. You know, these are difficult times for everybody. And I think the county has shown an interest in a strong public defender's office and has shown the importance of advocacy for the indigent. And I'm hopeful that we will continue to have that be the vision of Los Angeles today and into the future. These are unprecedented times, and the what I'll call compound crisis is from the COVID, from the budget, and the growing social movement and upheaval and protest to violence against African Americans by institutions that are designed to protect us and them has made for a very different landscape. And I'm hopeful that that landscape will help continue to bring positive attention to the role and importance of a strong and effective public defender's office.
Are you worried about having to make layoffs in a situation like this?
think everyone in the county right now and across the state is worried about reductions of that nature. It is something that nobody wants to go through. I am hopeful that at the end of the day, we'll see our way through this constructively and not find ourselves on that end of the conversation.
But you don't know for sure, right?
I think none of us know right now for sure what the end result is going to be. I'm hopeful, like I said. I think everybody is very concerned that if things turn out in the worst way they can be, that would have a grave impact on our ability to do our work.
Well, I wish you the best of luck, obviously, in some pretty turbulent times, and good luck getting back into the swing of things, too, starting on Monday. I want to thank you for your time, Ricardo Garcia, the top public defender for L.A. County. Mr. Garcia, thank you.
Thank you very much for this opportunity. You have a great and be safe out there day.
Moving on now with Greater L.A. on KCRW, I'm Steve Chiatakis. While attention in Los Angeles has been focused on street protests and the reopening of businesses from pandemic closures, some smaller cities in the area have been getting back to some semblance of normal. In Santa Barbara, for instance, people are dining out. They're getting haircuts, browsing the boutiques that line the city's main drag, State Street. And business owners have been processing everything that they've been through over the last few months.
It was awful. I don't have the words for it yet, how bad it was, how stressful it was, how much work we put in, how nervous we were, and all those things.
That's bar owner Brandon Restano. He's sitting at Shaker Mill. It's one of three downtown watering holes that he owns in Santa Barbara. Well, while all of his businesses have weathered the storm so far, there's still a lot to worry about. Santa Barbara, like the rest of California, is a big tourist draw. Last year, tourists spent $145 billion, that's billion with a B, while visiting the state of California. This year, experts think we'll only see about half that much. So what happens to this place and the other small cities that rely on tourism and hospitality, two of the hardest hit industries to get by? KCRW's Matt Gillum is in Santa Barbara and has a look now at how the city is using the pandemic to quite literally drive a different kind of tourism.
Let's start with hotel taxes. Not super exciting, but bear with me. In a normal year, which this is anything but, Santa Barbara sees more than 7 million visitors come to town who spend about $2 billion. When they're here, they eat, they shop, and they stay at hotels. But that all stopped in March, and the city's tanking hotel tax provides one of the clearest snapshots of what the city is up against now.
So it was down 62% in March. And remember, you know, our community really didn't close down until mid-March. And then transient occupancy taxes were down 93% in April.
Kathy Janega Dykes is the president and CEO of Visit Santa Barbara, the region's marketing organization. She says that plummeting bed tax translates to a loss of more than $2.4 million for city coffers. Worse, the tourism sector supports more than 13,000 jobs here. So, can Santa Barbara attract visitors when people are still afraid to travel? Janega Dykes thinks so because her local organization is getting a big assist.
Visit California, which is the state tourism office, is really helping us get prepared to reopen. For the first time, they will be promoting and focusing on in-state travel because that's what people want to do.
In our new era of physical distancing and masks, it's unlikely people are going to fly on a lark. Planes are the ultimate enclosed space, after all. This summer, experts say travelers are going to load up the car and drive to their getaway. Southern California has an embarrassment of riches when it comes to destinations a car ride away. There's Palm Springs in the desert, Idlewild and Big Bear in the mountains, and just north of Ventura, there's the so-called American Riviera.
Yeah, I know, this car, everybody.
That's a moniker Santa Barbara has claimed for years, but now they're really trying to own it. City leaders closed off the main street to car traffic and transformed it into a mile-long promenade. And honestly, it really does have a bit more of that je ne sais quoi. On a recent sunny day, people sat at tables along State Street's palm-lined sidewalks and even in the street itself, sipping wine and chatting with friends. Musicians performed on nearly every block. It's a night and day difference from before the pandemic, when State Street was frankly struggling to attract people.
It has taken this drastic situation for us to take drastic measures, what some people would consider drastic measures.
That's Santa Barbara Mayor Kathy Murillo. The idea of closing the street to cars had been kicking around for years, but with the economic devastation of the pandemic, she and other city leaders moved with lightning speed.
You know, certainly this is a time to experiment. This is time to try new things. And if people really like State Street not being open to vehicles, there's no reason why they shouldn't keep it.
And why not experiment when there's so little to lose? That's what David G. Schwartz says. He's a professor at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, who studies tourism and hospitality.
I think the benefit to what's happened is that basically everybody is starting from zero now. If Santa Barbara was going to make investments, was going to say, well, let's try something different, you wouldn't have to worry about people saying, well, you know, this has affected tourism. Instead, I think the headline would be, well, we're actually getting people to come here.
The sweeping change of closing State Street to cars has breathed new life into a downtown that's been flagging for years. Looking out at the crowded street from his old Havana-style bar Shaker Mill, owner Brandon Restano has high praise for the quick work Santa Barbara has done to draw people to the city's core.
In the last few weeks, the city of Santa Barbara, I think, is doing a fantastic job. They are pushing for, and they're one of the first communities in California to push really hard for businesses, bars, and restaurants, and retail in some capacity to push into the streets, sidewalks, and public right-of-way in a way that I think is incredibly exciting. It's cool that the city is being so proactive.
As he sips a tropical rum drink, Restano grows reflective. He calls the pandemic the most stressful period of his life and says he spent many nights questioning whether he and his wife were going to be forced to give up on their three bars. Now, it feels like those darkest days are behind him.
Feels like we're getting through this. We're almost there to the point where we could start to inch back towards being normal again, and we're excited and happy for that. I mean, we're going to look back in this 6 months from now and be like, I can't believe that was happening. I can't believe it. Well, it might be a year from now. We look back at this time and just be like, I can't believe we did that. Do you remember how much stress we were under? Do you remember how hard it was to sleep? All these kind of things. Well, I think we won't have those answers until time goes by and we have a nice, clear perspective on what the hell happened.
Uncertainty is part of the new reality all of us are grappling with. For Santa Barbara and other California getaway cities, business this summer is most likely to come from fellow Californians who are sick of being stressed out and quarantined and are ready to hit the road. For KCRW, I'm Matt Gillum.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. With a little help...
You know, my mother used to say, always look for the helpers. Anybody who is coming into a place where there's a tragedy. Because if you look for the helpers, you'll know that there's hope.
The signs read, I can't breathe. Say her name. Am I next? Just a sampling of the expressions and the heartbreaking pleas at LA's protests against the killing of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and countless other black people at the hands of white police officers. To help fellow protesters, LA artist Greg Ito put down his paintbrush and instead put together sign-making stations. Our art insider, Lindsay Preston Zappas, is editor-in-chief of Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles. We know it as Carla, and she's here now to tell us more about Greg Ito and the work that he's doing. Hi, Lindsay.
Hey, Steve.
Tell us a little bit more about Greg and these sign-making stations. What's he doing over there?
Yeah, so he's a local artist. He was born and raised here in Los Angeles. And basically, he's done three now where he's setting up these sign-making stations as central as he can to these protests as they get announced. And he sets up tables. He has cardboard, markers, wood posts to attach to the cardboard. They have PPE and hand sanitizer and a ton of volunteers. So he's just been doing these kind of rogue pop-up sign making stations, and he's done three, and each time they've slowly gotten a little bigger, more people have rallied behind it and started dropping off food and supplies. So it's quickly grown into quite the operation.
Yeah, sounds like a lot of helping going on. Why did he focus, Lindsay, specifically on sign making as a way to participate? I mean, is this his calling?
This is where I think his experience as an artist came in really key. When the protests started, he was looking at images that were circulating in the media coverage, and he saw that the images being chosen really focused on the signs, right? Because we can't always know what's in the heads of the protesters, but these signs are a way to like quickly get to the point of what they're thinking and why they're fighting. And so he really recognized the signs as like a key visual tool in conveying the message. So I feel like that's an artist brain a little bit, to kind of realize the power that the signs have in communication.
Where is he sourcing the materials from?
as an artist, you know, he often orders cardboard. So cardboard is used to pack up paintings and as kind of like a protection material around artwork. So he had a contact ready for big sheets of cardboard. So he was able to use that avenue to quickly purchase. His first protest, he spent about $300 of his own money and ordered the cardboard. He got the wood ordered, and he used his own table saw in his studio to cut down all the cardboard and wood to prepare for the protests.
I mean, you mentioned obviously the source materials that he's using, but also the PPE and the sanitizer and the food, you know, the snacks and things like that. That's not inexpensive. He's probably a struggling artist. So, I mean, where is this money coming from?
Right. He said that other people that were going to the protest just to drop off food and supplies kind of started dropping off at his booth because it was like a central space with tables. So it was really interesting how other people quickly jumped on board. But since that first one, it's scaled up. So for the second protest was 2 weekends ago in Hollywood, and he raised $900 through Instagram from just rallying community support and friends. For this last weekend, he was able to raise $1,200 on a GoFundMe campaign. So each time it keeps growing. And I think as he does it, more friends and family and community members recognize the importance of what he's doing. And people want to help out. Like, people are there to participate and volunteer and give snacks to protesters. So I think people kind of flock to what he's doing.
If this was a calling for him, I mean, did it start out that way? How did he get involved in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, I think like a lot of us, Greg started taking action from home, right? So we're all on Instagram. We're all looking at what to do next. And a lot of artists have been auctioning off artwork on Instagram. I've seen that quite a bit. And raising money for Black Lives Matter or other kind of related organizations. So Greg started there. He raised about $3,000 by auctioning off a drawing on Instagram for Black Lives Matter. But he told me that he was seeing a lot of digital activism and not enough on the streets. So he really, I think, felt called to be physical in this movement and get out there and get engaged in that way.
Is this the type of work that he's always done as an artist? Has he, I mean, design and signs and things like that? Or is this a departure for him?
He told me that he is in no way an activist until now. And he said that he always votes, but he doesn't really attend big protests or rallies. And he says that he was just an artist that was fed up with seeing the world not doing enough, and he didn't want to remain silent. So I feel like the story is about an artist kind of utilizing the tools around him or her to kind of creatively problem solve.
And obviously being out there can be a dangerous thing, especially in the midst of a pandemic. He got tested or is getting tested, right, for coronavirus. If he comes back negative for that, what's he planning to do next? More protests, more sign making?
Exactly. He told me he's also offering sign making kits now. I think he has some extra supplies. So if anyone is interested in kind of modeling what Greg is doing on your own, you can get in touch with him and make your own sign making station or have a little party to do that. So the best way to really reach out and get involved with what Greg is doing is via his Instagram account, and he welcomes people to get in touch or DM him to find out more.
We'll link that Instagram account on our website when we get it up and running today. What an interesting story. Lindsay Preston Zappas, our art insider and editor-in-chief of Carla. Lindsay, as always, thank you.
Thanks, Steve. Take care.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, Barbara Ferrer, director of the LA County Public Health Department, will come on the show to talk about the direction that the county and the state are headed in with COVID-19. We had another big jump today in new cases, more than 2,000, and whether things are opening up too early. We're online at kcrw.com/greaterLA, the latest on the pandemic and the unrest. Subscribe to the podcast, too, while you're there. Jenna Cagle, Nihar Patel, Sonia Geis, Amy Ta, Aaron Sine, Danielle Chiriguayo, Mario Diaz, Desmond Taylor, Mario Saavedra, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Amy Roken, and Christian Bordahl made this show happen today. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for your ears and for your time. Have a great day.